Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. My guest this for this month's book segment is Gianna Cleese Caldwell, whose newest book is The Small Scale Dairy. Welcome.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. Gianna Cleese's previous books were The Small Scale Cheese Business and Mastering Artisan Cheesemaking. And the subtitle of the new book is The Complete Guide to Milk Production for the Home and Market. And wow, this book includes so much information that I thought I should know and didn't know yet, and in a very friendly and palatable format. What made you write this particular book?
Well, having our own small farm and struggling and dealing and enjoying the day-to-day issues that trying to produce really high-quality raw milk brings, I wanted to try to be able to share all the little things that we've learned, all the little tricks that help empower the small producer and inform the small producer on how to do it really well and do it really well consistently, which is a challenge for any dairy of any size. And I like to help the little people, if you will, the little farmers, have the same kind of access to that information as somebody might at a larger scale.
And how? What does it add to the first book, The Small Scale Cheese Business?
If I had known that I was going to write this other one, I probably would have left some things out of The Small Scale Cheese Business and added some other things in there. It's too early to do a full new edition of the first book. But if I did, I didn't focus in the first book on the dairy side of it.
Okay.
It was all on the cheese plant side and nothing to do with animal husbandry and how that relates to high-quality milk. So this book is specifically for the milk.
Okay, it's more milk-oriented. Okay.
Right.
Now, you know so much in so many different fields and directions. How did you learn it all?
Well, I come from a family of do-it-yourselfers, and in the truest sense, as far as there weren't the options of hiring people, or if you wanted something done, you did it yourself. And it's ingrained in me, and it's also somewhat just of a it's an empowering thing to think, you know, if somebody else could learn to do something, I probably can learn it too. And then sharing that, I like to have a lot of things going on. I was originally a nurse, and if any profession requires keeping a lot of balls in the air at one time, I would say it's nursing. So I seem to like that sort of a thing. But yeah, it's nice to learn to do things yourself. And then we kind of have the philosophy, or everybody experiences this, if you do it yourself and you're not satisfied with the job, it feels entirely different than if you hire somebody and pay them and don't like the results. So you can live with it differently. Not that we don't try to do everything well, you understand.
Right. You can be mad at yourself instead of feeling gypped.
Yes. Exactly. Okay. And you can choose to redo, or you can choose to try to get better.
Right. Now, reading and studying, when you started the farm, did you and your husband split up areas to investigate or to be in charge of?
No, and that's been a very interesting organic process. I would say in some ways it was just a natural original split that has now merged into both of us doing most things. Originally, the goats were mine and our daughters, our youngest daughters, and all of that just fell to me. And then we've always been a good team, my husband and I. We've been together over 30 years. And we've always wanted to help each other in the best way we can. And so as he saw me struggling to get more done with the animals, he started doing more things with the animals. And it's every year something divvies up a little differently, I'd say, based on what those demands are. When I'm writing a book, he's super supportive and doing more things for me that he wouldn't do at other times.
And right.
He also has commitments. He's running for the board of the American Cheese Society and other things that then I try to take up the slack then.
Okay.
Yeah.
For our listeners, let me list some of the various areas of expertise that are covered in the book. I'm just touching on them. There's a lot about animals, cow, sheep, and goats. There's a lot about milk, biochemistry, and cleanliness. A lot about milking, decisions and procedures and cleanup, and the dairy setup, rooms, and again, more cleanup and lab tests. How long did the writing take of this book?
Well, it's kind of funny, Diane. It took probably twice as long as it should have.
Because?
for an entirely different reason. My editor and I originally envisioned the book as a very different book. And I finished that book and turned it in on time. I'm always on time.
Oh, good.
And, another thing that was ingrained in me. Then as she read through it, some things weren't working well for her, and I credit Chelsea Green, who are extremely great publishers, for having the foresight to see that this wasn't working. And the reason it wasn't working is because I had attempted to gear it toward an audience of both consumer and producer. And when in my heart, I'm really more, my expertise lies with helping the producers.
Right.
So then we talked about it and talked about it and decided to rewrite the whole thing to focus just on the producer with the hope that a very serious raw milk consumer would be interested in it also. So it still didn't take any longer than the other two books. I'm averaging about 2 years per book from start to finish, and it's a fun process. I like these long term processes.
Okay. When you changed the plan, did you go back and write more in depth on many of the topics?
Yes. Okay. Yes, definitely. I got to focus really deeply on the food safety part of it and all the things that only a producer would want to delve that deeply into.
Right. So the first plan changed into the second plan with the editor's help.
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, and writing a book such as this is definitely a team effort. An author, unless I'm just the only one that needs help, an author should rely on the wisdom of a publisher, I hope they're listening now, in knowing how something appears to a different audience.
Right.
And how to make that book meet its goals. You don't want to have a book where people get it and then they feel left wanting. And that's not what I want to do. So I appreciate that sort of a push.
Where do you fit writing into your day?
That's always a question. Luckily, I do, like I mentioned, like to have multiple things going on. And there are many days where there's no writing that occurs. And then I also write articles for a couple of magazines, too, so different kinds of writing. And a lot of times, though, I'm just thinking about the what I might be working on, and then working a lot during the slower season, which is late fall through late winter.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm traveling, I can take my little computer and work on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
No Angry Birds for me. Just use words, I hope.
Right.
And and I'm pretty efficient in, mm-hmm. with the time here on the farm. I like to make sure that time doesn't get wasted on effort that or other chores that doesn't really need to be there.
Were you a writer to start with? You said you were a nurse, but were you also writing before?
Well, I don't know if you had one of these when you were growing up, but the little school book where every year your mom would put your picture in there and you would sign your name and you would write what you wanted to be when you grew up. And,
uh-huh.
So far, I've hit on all of them. I wanted to be a nurse. I wanted to be an artist. I was a career visual artist for quite a few years. And mother was in there, and writer, and all of that. So I'm one of these people that I think that a career can be, you can have many careers in your life and be equally serious and equally committed to all of them. I did always want to write, but I wanted to write fiction. And I would still think that would be fun someday, but I don't think I have the skill for that at this point of the authors, similar to the authors that I would like to read.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and it's nice to, it feels really good to help people.
Mm-hmm.
And given how much work this career is, it feels like it's both two birds where I can get the satisfaction of writing and also have it contribute to our industry.
What were your favorite parts to write? What are the most fun?
Well, I learned a lot. My favorite thing overall about writing any book so far is how much I learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not kidding when I say it's actually a selfish act in having the excuse then to research and study and learn something more about what you're already doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think learning the history of milk and the final end, I don't know if you read the very last little like epilogue part of the book, but it really changed me, this process did, of writing this particular book, in feeling much more strongly about becoming a food rights advocate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the ridiculous level of oversight to some degree,
right.
and the lack of a great portion of the consumers in being willing to take responsibility for choosing food.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a paradox because if consumers are wanting protection, then that's what will happen. An attempt will be made at that.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked how it made me feel at the end,
mm-hmm.
and feeling more strongly about
mm-hmm.
that.
So more dedicated to the current food cause.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
and how important
mm-hmm.
that is, and how important it is to be informed as a consumer and not just look at food as something that is there all the time, and
mm-hmm.
it's not static.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I think that was my favorite part of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I found striking is how one of your early missions in the book is to give people the emotional reality of this life,
yeah.
of even just when you're talking about the animal lives and
yeah.
deaths, you're really trying to help people understand what they're getting into if they have this fantasy of, you know, getting a farm and making, you know, milking cows and making cheese.
Right. And it's wonderful that there is that romance around crafting beautiful food and producing it.
Mm-hmm.
But people can wrap their minds pretty readily around the level of work, physical work,
mm-hmm.
and the hours. But if you're at all sensitive or caring about the animals, and let's hope we all are, it can be quite painful.
Right.
It's I think if you were perhaps raised doing this, you might have not a tougher, but a ability to move on more quickly.
Uh-huh.
Our youngest daughter, who has gone through many lives and deaths here on the farm, and had to let go with a lot of things, and at the same time try to save a lot of things, has a super balanced perspective on life and death that I'm a little bit jealous of. But I don't want to be morbid about it, but you do. Death is around every corner here, and that is sometimes exhausting.
Right.
And you
and death of animals that you've grown to love.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a really good life as far as reality.
Mm-hmm.
You're never allowed to be too far from reality.
What would you say surprises new dairy farmers the most?
Say that again?
What would you say surprises new dairy farmers the most?
Oh, I don't know if I have a good singular answer for that. It's such a changing... Everything's changing all the time, and everything's not. I mean, your day-to-day routine is real similar, but then, for example, feed prices have gone up. The hay, since we started, which is only our license since 8 years ago, has gone up 75%, and it may go up more this year. And that's not something that ever could have been anticipated in a business plan.
Right.
So I think that would be probably, I don't know if it surprised us the most.
What were the hardest challenges for you?
Let's see. Dealing with the animal loss, like I was saying before, is always going to be the hardest for me. Most of us have these animals at this level because we want to have these animals. And then you realize that they're not pets. They can be companions, but they're not pets in the sense that most people can devote money to for veterinary care and that sort of thing. That would probably be the biggest challenge.
Like you have to make a financial decision at a certain point.
A financial decision that affects somebody's life.
Yep,
and that's tough.
Right.
But it's a reality, and I hope that over time that a great part of the consumers will come to enjoy paying more for products where animals are involved, because that will mean the farmer can afford to take better care of them.
Okay, it's time for our mid-show break. This is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd, interviewing Gian Collis Caldwell, author of the extremely informative book, The Small-Scale Dairy, and we'll be back in a moment.
Understanding when you are away, can't use my heart to think away the time. In my room I will await you, and so soon I will relate you, and tie your finger right on up to my...
You are listening to Josephine by the Hollows on the heritageradionetwork.org.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Till I get you right, my dear, so know that I will love you, and my heart sings high above you, takes away the doubt I have of fear. Sweet Josephine, you live in my dreams, sleep right by.
We're back on Cutting the Curd. This is Diane Stemple interviewing Gianacles Caldwell. And I thought we'd talk a little bit about the major brouhaha that just occurred a week or two ago when the FDA sounded like they were going to enforce the rules against aging cheese on wood shelves.
Right, right. And I guess that they clarified that. And it is truly that there is, and we all have understood this for some time, that there is no specific wording against aging cheese on wood shelves, but there is specific wording in the what they call the good manufacturing practices of food contact surfaces being what is called cleanable,
mm-hmm.
which means smooth and easily cleaned. And, of course, wood is not that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to give them quite a bit of understanding. We should all give them some understanding as far as...
The FDA?
Yes. Well, you know.
Okay. We'll give them understanding.
Yes. They're the good manufacturing practices that evolved around the cheese industry were around the industry that existed at the time,
mm-hmm.
which was not very artisan.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was any small producers aging on wood, they would have been hard to find.
Uh-huh.
The current way that the cheese industry is working now towards a lot more artisan production is going to require some tweaking of those. And I'm on the American Cheese Society Regulatory and Academic Committee,
mm-hmm.
which is a fantastic way for us to help the regulators learn a new paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
We need to, as producers, define what good manufacturing practices look like in an artisan facility. And that's something worth working on. And, the way the laws are now truly did reflect what was happening for the majority. Now, it becomes more difficult, in my opinion, the larger the food system grows, the more likely it is that regulators will want to streamline and make everything look the same,
mm-hmm.
for their ease of knowing what to look at. You know, you come into a little facility like ours, and it looks greatly different from anything even like 10 times our size.
Right.
And when I say look, I mean in what you see happening, what kind of products. But it doesn't mean that we can't do it at just the same exact level of quality and food safety, but it will look different.
Right. And your book is about all the ways to be as safe as possible.
Right. So I don't mind at all being a part of that, and I really was so excited to see the huge backlash of
cheese people everywhere.
Yeah,
right?
Cheese people rallying together.
And, yes, it was quite impressive.
Oh, it was, wasn't it?
All over the Facebook and the internet.
Ship and fired a warning shot right across the bow.
And then it seemed to have worked. I mean, that was the exciting part.
Yeah.
You know, usually you feel like you're throwing stones hopelessly. But
yes. It
seemed a week or so later, they were taking it back.
Right. And who knows? It is such a big body of the people and offices and laws. And maybe they were right in that it was just somebody overstepping their authority as far as making it sound as if it was a blanket statement. Who knows?
Uh-huh.
And I don't think it matters at this point. I'm actually really glad it happened. It I think it set a nice position, and it will give all of us cheesemakers a little bit more impetus to keep working toward defining mm-hmm. what good practices are, best practices.
Were you involved with the writing of the ACS statement?
All the, not so much as our fantastic executive director, Nora Weiser, but we all have our little input
mm-hmm.
and our little things to add from our perspective. And it's a great committee, it's a great team, it's mm-hmm. a great organization.
And that was great having that, you know, come out and be so steadfast and reassuring.
Mm-hmm, yes. Well, at the same time, wanting to be part of making things change and not setting up big adversarial situations.
Right. So let's get back to the book. Some of my questions, you just have so much content, and I have just a bunch of questions about different little things. You talk about having milk tasting sessions on the
uh-huh.
farm.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of milks do you offer, and who comes to the sessions?
Well, a couple times a year, we have what we call our Farmstead Cheesemaker Short Course,
mm-hmm.
where about six people that are really wanting to learn how to make a handmade artisan cheese on a farm
mm-hmm.
from the milk of their own animals
mm-hmm.
come and spend 3 days making cheese and learning to analyze milk for quality, bacteria counts,
mm-hmm.
all of that. And a sensory analysis of milk is important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll get milk from, we have two different breeds of goats, so we'll separate out those. And then I have great neighbors that have some dairy cows. I get some milk from them. And we do a variety, the same lab tests on all the different samples, and combine that then with the sensory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's milk, I think, is going to be the new frontier for trying to appreciate its differences.
Mm-hmm.
Our society is kind of accustomed to the ubiquitous white gallon
right.
that is the same across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'll find tiny little differences, but in animals that are fed similar diets, it's all going to be very similar, which is a great goal for a massive system.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to start tasting the local milk and tasting what those animals are eating through the milk, then of course that's going to translate for we cheesemakers into some pretty unique cheese.
Right.
Yeah, so I think training our taste buds to taste the milk is the first step. I don't think any cheesemaker can make cheese if they don't know what
mm-hmm.
tastes good
mm-hmm.
in milk.
Right. Now,
yeah.
One thing you say in the book is that individual animals, some have more pleasant milk than others.
Yes, that's very true.
I did not know this
yeah,
little fact.
Yeah. In fact, some of them, and who knows if it's nutritional imbalances for some.
Right. What do you think causes it?
Yep. Well, it could be many things. Hormonal differences,
mm-hmm.
a preference. If they're allowed to browse freely,
mm-hmm.
they may prefer some things that others don't.
And that makes their milk tastier.
It sure, or
mm-hmm.
less.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah, some animals have more milk sugar in their milk, and that will, of course, make it more pleasantly sweet.
Right. Will you breed the animals with better-tasting milk?
Well, I think you should. If you have that luxury and you're that small
mm-hmm.
to know how each individual's tastes year-round,
mm-hmm.
that's definitely something, but only if that same animal is good in other ways,
okay.
volume and
mm-hmm.
disposition.
Mm-hmm. So
for
there
the
are other
dairy farmer, you want cows and goats and sheep that are good workers and pleasant to be around and
mm-hmm.
not too unhappy. They need to be happy.
Well, you know, there's that advertisement that says happy cows make good,
yeah.
make better milk. So it could be a bad disposition has good milk?
That is a good theory to investigate.
Okay. You know, you write a lot about the lifestyle and finances of cheesemakers, and it just, as a cheesemonger, especially one promoting American cheeses, I'm always explaining how it's a lot of hard work and no one's getting rich.
Right.
And a lot of the consumers that are a little bit more distant from the cheesemakers, you know, don't like the prices of artisanal cheese.
Yeah. And well, I think they have a point, and I wouldn't hesitate to say that probably most of us cheesemakers couldn't afford our own cheese.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a system that is completely dependent on the farm, you know, no different price supports like you might find in Europe
right.
that help keep those prices down. And none of us, oh gosh, I don't know any small-scale cheesemaker that keeps track of their hours and...
Right, I'm thinking of hours. You would definitely look very underpaid if you kept track
yeah.
of hours.
We don't even want to know, actually. I really always, whenever I'm speaking or teaching, I emphasize that at the small scale that we are,
mm-hmm.
it's a lifestyle business,
mm-hmm.
meaning that your payoff is being able to do it.
Right.
And as
right.
long as you love that work and that lifestyle, if you want to be on the land, if you don't want to go to concerts,
mm-hmm.
then it's worth it. But if you're looking to have some sort of investment that you can sell or, you know, put anything away,
mm-hmm.
it needs to be much larger.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And that's fine with me. I like it.
Okay. Another one of your interesting facts is that when there's a sudden change in your milk in its test results or its quality. Mm-hmm. It's not usually the animals, but all the other factors that you discuss in the book, like cleanliness and chilling.
Yeah.
And could you talk more about that?
Oh, things can just change so quickly. In fact, one of the tests we do every time on our cheese batches, the last two were not impressive at all. The milk was yeasty and fermented poorly in this particular test that I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I had changed one thing in the process. I had switched from one type of little liquid detergent that I wash the udders with to
mm-hmm.
another.
Mm-hmm.
So now I've changed back,
okay.
and I'll check that test tomorrow.
Now, what
it,
made you change?
I'm always searching for something a little more environmentally friendly.
Okay. Okay.
And breaks down in the septic system better,
right.
all those things. So I tried a different product.
And I thought what was interesting in the book is how you want to dilute it so it works but doesn't leave a residue.
Yes, any chemical, especially, and of course, chemical shouldn't be a bad word because everything is made of chemicals.
Right.
But the dairy cleaning chemicals and sanitizing chemicals, in order for them to work properly, they need to be diluted properly,
mm-hmm.
used at the right temperature,
mm-hmm.
and then in accordance to how your water is.
Right.
Some people have very acidic water.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they go to use an alkaline detergent, which they all are,
mm-hmm.
it won't work well.
Right.
So all those things, they shouldn't be used without understanding their application. Because, first of all, they're expensive,
mm-hmm.
so you don't want to use more than you need to. And using less than you need to won't even do the job. So.
Right.
Yes.
A lot of details. What percent
yes.
of time do you feel is spent milking versus cleaning?
There's a lot of time cleaning.
Yeah.
And it's not even, we have a person staying here now to watch, and she's amazed at how much time is spent cleaning.
You know, it
and
doesn't
said,
sound
yeah,
that romantic.
Career.
It doesn't sound that romantic, the cleaning part.
It's not. But that's the time when your mind, once you get your routine down and don't have to think about every step quite
uh-huh.
so much,
uh-huh.
you can think about other things during that time and plan your dinner or something.
Uh-huh. Daydream.
Yes.
I used to sing when I had to cut up, 100 pieces of cheese. I would just sing
nice.
To myself. Anyway, well, that's it for this month's book review on Cutting the Curd. I want to thank you, Giannakis, for being a great guest and for your fine book, The Small Scale Dairy.
Thank you, Diane, and thanks for your great show.
Oh, thank you. And my next segment is on July 21st, and I'll be looking forward to talking to Michael Paternity, author of the cheese fiction book, The Telling Room. So I look forward to talking to you all then. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.